Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Marzalek, a host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South, a LGBTQ plus studies channel podcast of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking to Greg Burke about his new book, Gay, Catholic, and American, published by University of Notre Dame Press. In this compelling and deeply affecting memoir, Greg Burke recounts growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, and living as a gay Catholic. The book describes Burke's early struggles for acceptance as an out gay man living in the South during the 1980s and 90s, his unplanned transformation into an unspoken gay rights activist after being dismissed as a troop leader from the Boy Scouts of America in 2012, and his historic role as one of the named defendants in the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision Obergefell versus Hodges, which legalized same-sex marriage nationwide in 2015. After being ousted by the Boy Scouts of America, former Scoutmaster Burke became a leader in the movement to amend anti-gay BSA membership policies. The Archdiocese of Louisville, because of its vigorous opposition to marriage equality, blocked Burke's return to leadership, despite his impeccable long-term record as a distinguished Boy Scout leader. But while making their home in Louisville, Burke and his husband, Michael DeLeon, have been active members at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church for more than three decades. And their family includes two adopted children who attended Lourdes School and were brought up in the faith. Over many years and challenges, this couple has managed to navigate the choppy waters of being openly gay while integrating into the fabric of their parish life community. Burke is unapologetically Catholic, and his faith provides the framework for this inspiring story of how the Burke DeLeon family struggled to overcome anti-gay discrimination by both the BSA and the Catholic Church, and fought to legalize same-sex marriage across the country. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me today.
I'm excited about having you here. I wondered if you could begin by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Right. Well, I think you got some of the cliff notes in that description of the book. It did tell a little bit of my life story. I'm a native of Louisville, Kentucky. I grew up here. I went to Catholic schools. Also, after that, attended the University of Louisville, the University of Notre Dame, and the University of Kentucky. So I've had most of my life experiences, you know, in kind of a small region, you know, kind of circling around the Louisville area. But it's been quite an interesting journey. You know, I came out in 1976, so I've been out of the closet for a very long time. I was a sophomore at the University of Louisville when I came out. I was 19 years old, and you know, there weren't a lot of people that were doing that in 1976. So it's been a long, long, difficult road at times to kind of claim that identity and, you know, protect myself as I've moved through the stages of life, you know, to make sure that I navigated things as best I could. And I think I've done a decent job with that so far.
Mm. And also, you know, I should say that you were 2015 Person of the Year. You and your husband were Persons of the Year by the National Catholic Reporter. And you were also a Person of the Year for Out Magazine, I believe, in the same year.
Right. I was, let's see, I don't know what they would call that. I was recognized as one of their top Out 100's top most influential LGBTQ people. This was primarily for the work that was done with Scouts for Equality and my efforts to get the Boy Scouts of America to modify its discriminatory membership policy. So that really started in 2012 and 2013. That was the period where the Boy Scouts ousted me from my role as a scoutmaster for simply for being openly gay. Their policy did not permit that, so they kind of came after me with a vengeance. And you know, in response to that, I decided that it was time for me to get involved and try to do something to change that policy. So I partnered with an organization, as I said, Scouts for Equality, and we got very active, I would say, over a couple of year period to try to persuade the Boy Scouts to change their policy. And in fact, they ultimately did. In 2013, the Boy Scouts finally modified their youth membership policy so they would allow gay adults to be members of the Boy Scouts. And then in 2015, the Boy Scouts finally changed their adult membership policy so that gay men and lesbian women could be scout leaders. So it was a long path in a lot of respects, but that was what was the impetus for my getting involved really in activism.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that, because throughout the book, as you talk about becoming an activist, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it almost comes across like this is not something you ever expected to be, an activist.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that way. If you talk to people who are activists now, they describe themselves as accidental. In my case, I wouldn't say it was accidental. It was kind of thrust upon me. I feel like it was really more of a calling. And as you read my book, you'll hear a lot of what I feel like are callings for me to do certain things, callings out of my faith to be active or to do particular things. And I do feel like that was a calling for me to get engaged with the Boy Scouts and try to change things and make it better. Because I wasn't the only one. It was personal for me, and it harmed me. But there was collateral damage. There were a lot of other scouts that I mentored over the years. My troop was damaged by that. And across the country in 2012, in particular, 2011 and 2012, the Boy Scouts were on a tear trying to identify and oust anybody that they thought was gay or lesbian. So it was a very troubling time, very difficult. And I felt like out of that, I was kind of forced into a position where somebody had to do something. And I felt like it needed to be me.
Yeah, there's an interesting place in the book where you talk about your son. And I should say in the book, you read about how your husband and you adopted two sons, which was just so wonderful to read about that. And you talk about how one of your sons came to you and said he was interested in being in the Boy Scouts. And you kind of talk about some of your internal dialogue there.
Oh, right. Our youngest, that would be our oldest son, Isaiah, started at our Catholic school. Well, he was there through preschool and kindergarten. But in first grade is when the Boy Scouts and the Cub Scouts make their active pitches to the members of the schools. Mm. So Isaiah went to... it was during the first week of his grade one year at Our Lady of Lourdes, and he came home with a flyer from the Cub Scouts, and he said that he wanted to join. Hmm. At that point, my husband and I talked about it, and we really didn't think it was appropriate because we were well aware of the Boy Scouts policy on being discriminatory, and we were just concerned about the messaging that he might get. And we didn't want to have him be exposed to that potentially. So we talked him out of it, for grade one. But then at the beginning of his second year, he came home again. The Boy Scouts made another appeal, and he talked to us about it. He really wanted to do it. So Michael and I kind of grudgingly agreed to let him do this. But what we didn't realize was that when you have a child in Cub Scouts, you have to have an adult there all the time with your child.
Oh, yeah.
So that meant that, Michael and or I had to be involved at all of these meetings. So we were kind of forced to get involved as parents. Not that we didn't want to be. We were, you know, doing a lot of other things. For example, that same year, Michael was soccer coach for the Lourdes first grade team. So, and then he did it in second grade too. So, yeah. You know, we were involved in a lot of other ministries and did other things at church. But we weren't ready for that. You know, we really didn't think the Cub Scouts was going to be the best way for our son or us to spend our time, even though Michael and I were both Boy Scouts growing up. And, you know, we loved the program. You know, we thought it was very, could be very good in terms of, you know, building skills and self-confidence. And we realized that there were a lot of benefits to it, but we were just really reluctant about letting our child start because we didn't know where it was going to go. But, you know, we took a chance and, the rest is in the book.
The rest is in the book. That's exactly right. The rest is in the book. Yeah. Yeah. And kind of skipping around a little bit, but you tell the story of your experience with the Boy Scouts. And then of course we'll get into as we continue in the interview, but you know, your whole experience with the Supreme Court case and the cases leading up to that. But what led you to write this book in the first place?
Well, again, I would say it was sort of a calling. There is a scene that I describe, I think, in the book. I'm not sure if you recall it or not. One day I was in church. Michael and I are regular mm-hmm. participants at our church. We go every Saturday night. And I was sitting there, and there was a particular moment during the Mass where I had this sort of wake-up call or this jolt to attention. And yeah. And I do describe it in the book. It's a kind of a hard thing to sell to people. If it hasn't happened to you, then you know it's a hard thing to buy. But something transpired, and it really forced me to start reflecting on what I had been through and what I might be able to do to kind of tell our story in a way that I think would be compelling to people and might help change some hearts and minds, particularly in the Catholic community where there has been so much, you know, just so much negativity and marginalization of the LGBT community. You know, I really feel like we need to kind of change the narrative in our church. And I was hopeful that writing this book would help kind of move that discussion in a different way.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a place, I think it's towards the end when you talk about this, you know, your decision to write the book, that you you say that you wanted, as you wrote the book, you said you omitted much of the controversial and I think you said painful material. And I, not asking you to reveal what that was about, but I wondered what you meant there when you said that.
You know, I think it's possible to tell a story without telling every detail. Yeah, a couple of places in the book, I think I alluded to the fact that I'm like every other creature that God put on this planet. You know, I've had challenges and temptations, and I've done things that I regret. I've had things happen to me that, you know, are embarrassing that I, you know, don't want to share with other people. And so those are deeply personal things that I don't think were really particularly relevant to the story because, if you read the story, I think you can tell I'm pretty much bearing everything I've got.
You are.
Memoir. And a lot of it is very emotional. A lot of it was extremely difficult. Can't imagine some of the emotion that I felt and the things that I went through. In terms of being forced to leave my position at the Boy Scouts. And I'll tell you, it was very contentious. And this is kind of one of the things that I was alluding to, is that people can be very ugly and were very ugly and very threatening at times. And I didn't want to tell the story as if I was a victim because I feel like the story of my life is one of perseverance and overcoming these various obstacles that have been put in front of me. And so what I meant to say was it was probably harder than I made it sound at times because there's just a lot of bad stuff that's happened. But, yeah, you know, in the end, you know, the Boy Scouts have changed their policies. We now have marriage equality. You know, things are shaking up in the Catholic Church. I mean, there's just been just a lot of progress. And so I don't want to have anybody think of me as a victim along the way. Certainly things have happened to me, and you can, you know, again, they're in the book, and people can read about those and make judgments if they choose to do so. But I as a Catholic and a Christian, do not want to cast judgment on any parties, including people who might have done me wrong in the past.
And I, you know, as I was reading the book, it really, I kept thinking to myself, it was really like somebody, like reading somebody's personal journal, because the way you wrote, and I was impressed how you did that, because it sounds like you went back and rewrote this story after it occurred, but it read like it would have been happened. You were writing a journal after each day that something happened.
Right. And I did not. So it was very reflective and after the fact. But what I tried to do was to put myself in the mindset of whatever period I was in. I kind of put on blinders, and I was writing as if I didn't know what was going to happen, you know, 6 months or a year or 2 years or 3 years later. It was like I was addressing what was happening at that time and where I was and what was going on in the world, what our children were dealing with, what our relationship was dealing with. I thought that was kind of the best way to describe it. And, you know, a lot of that I think is really important because, you know, I am of a generation that lost just a phenomenal number of people to the HIV/AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
And there, you know, sure, there are plenty of survivors, but, you know, Michael and I were together even before that started. So, you know, we lived through all of that where we saw friends and oh my gosh, it was just dying everywhere and suffering. And it was just so sad. So I think it was important to kind of go back and put myself into those different periods in time, you know, the early 80s when Michael and I met and we just started our relationship. I think I talked quite a bit about that, you know, and then as we kind of progressed through the different phases of our life, as, you know, having, you know, being young people in a relationship and moving and, you know, going through some of the challenges related to work and then deciding to become parents. I mean, there are many phases that we've been through in our life. And, you know, there are a lot of gay couples or lesbian couples, for that matter, who can say that they've been through that that experience for this length of time, you know, with you know, everything we've been through, you know, from the early 80s to here we are in 2001. Michael and I will celebrate 40 years together next year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. But it's literally, it's been a lifetime we've spent together. And we've been through all those different phases, and we've seen so much history and so much evolution over those 40 years. It's been really remarkable. And now, you know, in the last 10 years or so, we seem to have been involved in some of that history. So that was another reason why I really thought it was important to write this book, because I think it's helpful for people to know the story behind some of these landmark Supreme Court decisions. There were a lot more plaintiffs in that case, excuse me, than you may realize. There were 37 plaintiffs in Obergefell versus Hodges, and there are that many stories. So, you know, I just thought that I'm one of the 37. I've got a few things to say. And I thought it was important for me to commit that as a writer yourself. You know how difficult it can be to write a book. This, I'm a first-time author, so this was an extreme challenge for me to be disciplined enough to get this done while I'm working a full-time job, right? So it was particularly challenging for me, but I thought it was important, being part of a case like that, to at least capture my experience, or I should say our experience, our family's experience. And I would encourage, you know, any of the other plaintiffs who were involved in that case to write their stories, because I think people would be interested to read those as well.
Yeah, it was really eye-opening to read about your experience. And one of the things that I appreciated that you talked a little bit about was the fear of recrimination at times. I think at one point you said something like, as you were writing about this fear that something could happen, especially during the Supreme Court case, that you, I think you said you felt a little PTSD just writing this, you said.
Right. It was very traumatic. As you indicated, I did have to go back and put myself through those times of turmoil in my life. So a lot of it was with the Scouts. A lot of it was with the Supreme Court case. It was very traumatic, not only because we were very unpopular when we filed our lawsuit for a variety of reasons, but there was a lot of animosity, you know, and just if you could have read some of the comments on, you know, some of the articles that our local, in those days, our local newspaper would publish an article and allow anyone to comment. And if you just could have seen and captured the hate that was there, it was remarkable. You know, and then just strange things happened that were disturbing, you know, with people and comments and, you know, things showing up in the mail. And, you know, thank God nothing ever happened to us. But, you know, we were always sort of living on the edge and concerned about what might happen. And that, you know, that was one of the things I did describe in the book, is I used to lay in bed at night staring at the window, wondering if there was going to be a brick or a fire bomb come through the window while I'm laying there sleeping. And, you know, what's going to happen to my family? It was very traumatic, not only to go through that, but then to have to go back and relive it all again when I was writing it out and then revising it and rewriting it. You know how it goes when you're writing. Tough.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think that you really explain really well what it's like when somebody is LGBT plus and there's that constant fear that somebody's going to attack them or come at them because of who they are. And then it's even multiplied for you because you're front and center in the public eye.
Right. And even before that, I mean, we were openly gay at our church, and we always thought that there was a chance that there could be, you know, all it takes is one crazy person to go off the deep end. And, you know, that could have been the person that decided to target us or our family. Yeah. And fortunately, it didn't happen, but that didn't keep us from thinking about it and worrying about it.
And then on the other side, you have some really just, I imagine, must have been really joyous experiences. Obviously, when I don't know if you could talk about this a little bit, what it was like when you and your children were in the Supreme Court when the decision was announced.
Right. Yeah, that was such a great experience for our family. Yeah, I'll start by saying that we were our family was also there on April 28th of 2015 for the oral arguments.
That's right.
And that was a very important day. And probably, I mean, there were so many more plaintiffs there, and there was just so much interest because that was the day the arguments were made. There was so much demand to get into the court on that day that our children were not able to be seated. So even though our children...
Oh, they were in the cafeteria, right?
Yeah, right.
I think you said in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, for argument day. So they were thrilled when we were there on decision day that they were actually able to enter the court with us, and they were able to sit with us and hear the decision read, and they were part of that. They were disappointed that they weren't able to join us on oral arguments day, but you know, the court itself as a space is surprisingly modest for someone who's never been there before. I thought it was going to be more like a huge auditorium, and really it's quite small. So there's not unlimited space for seating, and you know, there was an order to how it was decided who would be able to attend. And our children couldn't go for oral arguments, but they were there on their decision day. And we had a really great family outing. I'll just describe it like that. It was so joyous. It was so exciting. But again, back to what we were just talking about, we weren't sure that we were going to win, right? I mean, we thought we were, but we had the narrowest of margins. And we were thinking the whole time we were sitting there, it's like all it would take would be one of those justices to flip and decide that this was going to be just going too far. Just 2 years before that, there was the Windsor decision and the Prop 8 decisions that were decided by 5-4 votes. So again, the narrowest of margins. So as we're sitting there, we're well aware of the fact that all it would take would be one justice to change their mind. And it was a totally different argument. So it's not even like they were deciding on the same case again. I mean, it was a totally different case. And it really could have gone either way. And that was something that was weighing on our minds. It weighed on the minds of all the plaintiffs, I can tell you, because we talked about it. It's like the what if. What if we lose? What does that mean? What does that mean for all the people who are already married or who might have been recognized as married by some of the other district and circuit court rulings that had been rolling through the country for the year or so prior to that? Just a lot of weight and concern on our shoulders. So to be able to go from that to having Justice Kennedy stand up and start to read the majority opinion, that was just talk about a mood swing. We took the elevator right to the top, and it was a glorious feeling. It was something that I probably will never experience anything like that again in my life. It lasted for a while that day, and even beyond that day. But in particular, that day, it was pretty remarkable. Unfortunately, being in the court, it's like we had to be completely stoic and could not react in any way. The court has very strict rules about behavior, and if there would have been any outburst of any kind, that person would have been removed. And you might recall, you might remember back during the oral arguments, there was a gentleman who caused a scene during the arguments, and he was physically removed from court. Yeah. So they take the whole decorum thing very seriously. And so we knew that we had to sit there basically and just kind of stare blindly and not overreact. Kind of wait until we got out of court to have our opportunity to express our joy.
Yeah. I remember reading that you had to go out the back because there were so many people on the steps of the courthouse celebrating in the front. Right.
We didn't know that. And I talk about that in the book. It's like we were trying to have, kind of that moment where the triumphant plaintiffs walk out the back of, the steps of the walk down the steps of the United States Supreme Court, right? And you go down and there was a sea of people there. There was, an army of media that was waiting to talk to us. And, we just wanted to go out the doors and walk down those steps. And we got there and they wouldn't allow anyone to leave. And we didn't understand why. We heard someone say something about a bomb threat. And so we were concerned. But the security forces at the Supreme Court said, you can't go out this door. You have to go out the side of the building and then walk around the front of the plaza. So so we did that. And the only thing we'd heard at that point was that something about there was a bomb threat. So we thought, we were being evacuated because there was a bomb threat. And then we got outside and we were told that, no, what happened was when the decision was made known public outside, that there was a rush, the people on the plaza kind of rushed the steps. And so to regain security in the premises, they had to push everybody back down, and they were keeping the doors clear. It was a wild scene. And then, of course, we went out to the plaza, spent a great deal of time talking to the media, talking to the crowd. It was really a fantastic experience. Just so much joy. And, you know, people ask all the time what that was like. And I just describe it as it was like winning the gay Super Bowl. That's just the way I felt.
You said that in the book. Yeah. Yeah. My husband and I were married in Maine in 2013. And so we weren't legal in Mississippi, obviously. So when we heard the decision, you know, it meant all of a sudden we're legal. So it was like you say in the book, I think every person who was affected by this remembers where they were standing or what they were doing when this decision came down.
Isn't that right? I mean, maybe it's just me because people talk to me about it all the time. They know I was part of the case. But it does seem to me remarkable that when Michael and I talk to LGBT people throughout the country, that everybody's got a story about that. I mean, they say, I remember exactly where I was. I remember who I was with. I remember how I found out. I remember what we did to celebrate. It's just people, it was this moment that we all shared that was one of joy and this feeling of, oh my gosh, it's finally here after all these years we've waited so long for it. And it's a remarkable thing to be able to have been part of making that happen for so many people.
Yeah, I was just thinking, so you and your family were in D.C. when the Obama White House lit up the White House in rainbow colors.
Right. Yeah. We didn't see it. We were just, the day was a whirlwind. Think you might remember. So we flew into D.C. late that night before, and we had to get our kids up. You know, we had teenagers, so it was hard enough. Had to get our kids up and get them to court by 7 o'clock, you know, and everybody had to get up and get cleaned up and get dressed and, you know, get ready for the cameras. So we had our kids up early that morning. So by, 7 or 8 o'clock, it's like we were so exhausted, having run through just this lengthy day of activities and interviews and just excitement. I mean, we were beat. So that, you know, I didn't know that the White House was lit up and that Michelle Obama was out there partying with people, or we would have we would have been over there if we knew. Exactly.
So you got to meet some really interesting people, and one of them that really stood out for me was you described your communications with Edie Windsor.
Right. Yeah, we had quite a remarkable, I would call it a friendship with Edie, although, you know, we'd never had a chance to spend that much time together. But she was a huge cheerleader of ours. We Michael and I met Edie at the At 100 Gala.
Okay, that's right.
And, you know, we spent an extensive amount of time talking. At that point, when we met her, our case was still at the district level. So we were only able to describe ourselves as, you know, the Kentucky marriage equality plaintiffs because, you know, we had filed first in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. But she was just so excited to hear that the case, that all of the cases across the country were moving forward and that hers was being used as, you know, kind of the foundation for that and the precedent. So we had a splendid evening with her. And after that, we carried on, email communications. And she was a huge fan, I would say, and she was rooting for us to be successful in our case. You know, I would let her know whenever there were any developments. At one point, I told her we were thinking about coming to New York for a spring break with our kids, and you know, she wanted to have us over and order pizza. Mm-hmm. It's like, I truly regret that we never had a chance to do that because I wish I could have had more time with her. You know, she was such an important person in the history of LGBTQ rights development.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish I had more time. But you know what? When you live in Kentucky, it's like you don't get many opportunities to rub elbows with, you know, with the movers and shakers in the movement. It's like the gay royalty, it's like in the South. Yeah. You know, in the South, it's totally different in the South. And you know, about the only time we had opportunities like that was when we went to to New York or another city for an event of that nature. But most of us, I think, are in our little communities and towns in the South, doing what we can to move things forward and change things. And you know, it's not the kind of stuff that gets covered in Out Magazine or The Advocate. It's important work that we're all doing, and I think we all need to keep that in mind as we keep kind of knocking down some of those barriers and doing the work that we need to do in all of our Southern communities as well.
Yeah, and I guess kind of going back and forth, but that kind of takes us back to your whole experience with the Boy Scouts, because I imagine over the years, when you talk about in this book, that the people that you knew locally, never, you being an openly gay man in a same-sex marriage, didn't seem to be an issue. That people, they knew about your expertise and your commitment and your experience in the Boy Scouts.
That's absolutely true, especially with the people at my parish. So the way the Boy Scouts works, every unit has a sponsoring organization. And most of those sponsoring organizations are religious organizations, so different types of churches. So at my church, you know, because Michael and I had been there for so long and we'd been openly gay, it's like everybody at Lourdes knew we were gay. And they knew our kids because, you know, they'd been through the preschool and the kindergarten and, you know, through the various grades. And so everybody had the opportunity to get to know us and accept us and, you know, not have concerns or issues. Another thing that I did talk about in the book, that which I think is important, and it seems to be fundamental to scouting, is that leaders don't grow on trees. Usually, leaders are born from a desperate need for somebody to step up and do the job, or the unit's not going to exist anymore. And that's what happened in my case. I did not want to become a leader, but our son Isaiah was really enjoying scouting. And we had kind of a crisis in leadership, and someone had to step up. And at that particular point, I decided I was going to do it. And so I had that kind of dual experience that I talked about, where I was openly gay with our scout unit. I mean, they knew, the people of our church knew, but whenever we kind of left the bubble of our church community and did something with the Lincoln Heritage Council, the Boy Scout Council, or if we did anything that was like a jamboree or kind of a regional event, it's like that's when I had to go back in the closet, because I never knew how people were going to react when I got outside of that bubble. So it really put me kind of in the closet when I went outside of the Lourdes community and I was taking kids to summer camp, or you know, we were going to a different scouting event, and I, like a merit badge fair or something like that, and I'm taking them. It's like then I had to be really cautious about how I conducted myself and who knew what. And that was a difficult kind of relationship to manage for me, because as I said, I came out when I was 19, and I've been pretty much out everywhere, you know, with family and work and everything for all that time. And so when I got involved as a Boy Scout leader, that's when I really had to take a step back and say, okay, for the benefit of my son and the troop and everybody else, is like I've got to play this cool and just play the don't ask, don't tell kind of role as a leader. And I did that for a few years, but that's just something that was not sustainable for me. It could be done for a brief period of time, but it wasn't a long-term solution.
It must have been exhausting having to do that when you went outside the local area.
Well, anybody that's in the closet or, you know, has to play those kind of games, I think it's exhausting for them. And that's why so many people just, you know, tire of it and reach that breaking point where they say, I'm not going to do this anymore for my own health, for my own benefit. It's, you know, I can't do this anymore. And that's really where I was. And that's why I felt it was necessary to talk to the Lincoln Heritage Council and, you know, try to see where they stood on the subject. And if you read the book, you know, that's like, that's not the first time I did something like that. I mean, I've gone numerous times to Catholic priests and said, okay, we're joining this parish. Michael and I are a couple. Are you okay with that? And so I kind of like to to make sure I've got clearance and acceptance before I get too invested in things.
Sure.
But it was similar in many ways with the Boy Scouts. But Boy Scouts, you know, are a much larger institution. The same way the Catholic Church is a much larger institution. And within those institutions, you can have pockets of people who are, you know, quite progressive. But then you also have people on the other end who are just the total opposite. And if they have any notion, you know, if they had any notion that there was a gay scout or a gay leader or a lesbian leader, it's like they were going to flush them out and make sure that they were removed. That's the way it was. And the church has the same similarities in a lot of respects. You've got pockets of the Catholic Church that are very welcoming and progressive. I would cite my own parish as one of those. Mm-hmm. And then you have other parishes in the same city here in Louisville that have a reputation for being, I think, very very conservative and sometimes even homophobic. So it's just really hard to reconcile all that variation in approach in one organization. But, you know, the Catholic Church has had that issue for eons, and they probably will continue to have that issue for quite some time.
Yeah, and you really, the dissonance in the church really came out for me as I read your book. You know, I was thinking about the positive experiences you described with parishioners and your involvement as a communion minister and other things that you were involved with in the church. But then at the same time, the experience you know, with the Archbishop, not putting pressure on the local church not to allow you to be a scout leader. And then also that when your design for a memorial in a cemetery was declined.
Right. Yeah, there were a couple of instances where the Archdiocese really took a hard stand with us. And you mentioned with the Boy Scouts, I mean, I was given a hard no that I would not be permitted to return to scouting in 2015. The Boy Scouts of America changed their policy and said that they would not discriminate anymore, but they wouldn't prohibit sponsoring organizations from discriminating if they chose to do so. And my Archdiocese flatly told me, no, you will not be able to return to leadership. And then there was the other case that you mentioned where my husband and I, we bought plots in a Catholic cemetery in Louisville. It's the cemetery where all of my family gets buried. Mm-hmm. And in fact, yeah, we're going to be like three rows away from my parents and, you know, a host of aunts and uncles. My brother's going to be right next to me. But the interesting thing was that when we went to have our headstone designed, my cousin, who worked at the archdiocese then, told me that they had just implemented a policy that any same-sex couple would have to have their monument approved by the archdiocese. It was a new rule just after marriage equality had been decided upon, and the archdiocese was taking steps, I think, wherever it could, to kind of single out gay couples or, you know, same-sex couples to find ways to discriminate against them. It was very disturbing. And, you know, I try not to dwell too much on that. There was some good things that came out of that I thought were important. For example, the Archdiocese said that we could be buried together. They said that we could have a shared monument. It's just that they refused to let us have certain elements on our tombstone. For example, interlocking wedding rings, because it's a symbol of marriage, right? But if you go into that cemetery and you look around, I'll tell you, 50% of the married couples that are buried together have those interlocking rings. It's extremely common. So, it was troubling. So, between the Boy Scouts and then those issues, that certainly did cause me some concern. But, you know, I have to say, overall, those are some important things, but in so many other ways, the church has not acted against us. And, you know, people ask us all the time, why do we stay in this church? You know, why do we stay in a church where we're not welcomed or that, you know, that treats queer people so poorly and marginalizes folks? Why do we stay? And, you know, I like to try to turn that around on people and say, well, what I want to know is, why has the church allowed us to stay? You know, for 34 years, we've been going to this church, and Michael and I have been practicing together for 39 years. But for 34 years, we've been going to this church, and we've been openly gay. And at no point have we ever been asked to leave. You know, we haven't been denied communion. You know, we haven't been told we couldn't participate in ministries. So they have certainly cashed all of our checks. I can guarantee that. you know, they've been really overall welcoming, and they haven't asked us to leave or forced us to leave. So with the bad things that we talked about, I would say that the good things that we have experienced by being members of this faithful community greatly outweigh any of those negative things. You know, I wish I could describe better the feeling that Michael and I get when we go to this church. I mean, we go to church on Saturday night, and it's like walking into Cheers. It's like we know everybody. Everybody knows us. You know, for a half hour before Mass starts, everybody's walking around the pews asking them, you know, how's your surgery? You know, how's your son? It's like, it's you know, it's family time. And that's what I love so much about the Catholic Church, and in particular the one that we go to. But I think that so many of them have that characteristic. They are another representation of family. And it's a family that, you know, we get to share with our faith or in our faith. So anything bad that's happened to me so far in the Catholic Church, it's like it's nothing compared to all the joy and the acceptance that, you know, we have received over the years as being Catholic.
Yeah. And, you know, your experience is what seems to be so common for so many people that I've talked to. And I should say that I grew up Catholic also. And I don't practice anymore. I think I've chosen, you know, some people choose to stay in the church like you have, and some people choose to leave and go down other routes. And I think that I've known so many people like myself who've had the experiences you're describing. Right. And yeah, yeah.
I know. Well, it's painful to stay at times, and I know it's painful to leave. I know a lot of people who have left, and you know, they talk about, you know, missing it, missing the, you know, the all the ceremony and everything that goes along with it. But you know, I wouldn't want anybody to stay someplace where they don't feel welcome. And I wouldn't stay someplace if I didn't feel welcome. If I was treated, Michael and I were treated poorly at our church, you know, we would be finding someplace else to go. But that's never happened. And that's my point, is that, you know, they've never forced us to leave.
It's a family.
They've never even encouraged us to leave. So I think we just really got lucky with our experience with this particular parish that we've been members of for so long. And I wish everybody could find something like that, whether it's in the Catholic Church or in another faith tradition. It's I think it's important to be able to have that connection, you know, and other people find ways to make that same connection, you know, whether it's, you know, a bowling league or, you know, pick something else. But obviously my faith is important to me. You started by reading that description of the book, and it describes me as being unapologetically religious, and that's not my term, but I kind of like that because I do feel that way. The same way I'm not going to apologize about being gay because I don't think it's anything to apologize about, I'm not going to apologize for being what I think is a religious person in my mind, and someone who's been faithful and, you know, kind of lived that life and decided that was important for me. And that's the way I wanted to live my life. So I'm not going to, there's a lot of things, and especially when you get to be my age, it's like, I'm not going to apologize about just being who I am, because I'm pretty
who
content
you are, yeah,
with where I am and the decisions I've made.
Yeah. And there's a place in the book where you talk about the importance you see in having people to fight from the inside.
Right. So that's another thing that people need to think about, is if everybody leaves the church, then what's left? You know, everybody that has an issue with the church, whether you're a, you know, a divorced person or a woman who wants to participate in ministries, or you're an LGBT person, if all of the people who have been marginalized by a lot of the Catholic doctrines and policies left, what would that look like? I mean, it would not be pretty. So I think it's important to have people there advocating for progress, for inclusion, for equity, for, you know, all the things that we talk about in our greater society that are so important to us as ideals. You know, we need to have people that stay in the church and argue for those same things. And that's what we do. You know, if Michael and I weren't there for the last 34 years and we had vacated that space, that could have left room for, you know, some other, you know, right-wing conservative person to come in and have the totally opposite effect. So we feel like that at least, you know, by our being there, at the very least, we're neutralizing that. You know, and people, as I said, have grown to know us, they love us, they treat us like family. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why we stay, is because it helps keep things in a place where we think it should be. And again, it's like, I just don't, if we vacate the space, you know, we just give up the war and, you know, bad things happen.
And that really comes strongly. That really comes through strongly in your book. And I think you said in the beginning of the interview that that was one of your goals, to be able to show people that it's possible to be queer and be in the church at the same time.
Right. Yeah, I think that's important for people to see, especially young people when they're starting out. And, I've had some experiences with some young folks, some young Catholics here in Louisville especially, and have really wanted to give them the impression that you don't have to choose between your identity as a Catholic and your identity as a queer person, that you can do both, because, you know, we've been doing it for decades, and, you know, it's not easy all the time, but you can do it. So if you want to do it, that's an option. You know, life is full of options, especially when you're young. And I just, you know, as an old Catholic person, it's like, I feel like I need to encourage people, young people, to remain in the faith, stay in the faith, because the church is important to me.
We're coming close to the end of our interview, but I wanted to ask you an important question, and that's, what is it you hope that people will take from reading your book?
Well, I think it is a story that kind of builds. I mean, it's not a story, it's, you know, real life, but it's written as a story, and you get to the end, and I in the last few pages, I have the opportunity to make what I call my closing argument. And I describe our life together, my life together with Michael, as a couple. And I describe it in terms that is non-gender specific, just a couple, you know, that couldn't biologically have children. And, you know, we adopted, and then, you know, we were involved in our church and we were involved in all these ministries. And what I wanted to do was to lay the groundwork for people in the Catholic Church to think about what gay marriage same-sex marriage might look like in the church, because a lot of people just, you know, have this block, this mental block, because church leadership has been preaching against same-sex marriage for quite some time. And so it's just, they can't accept it. They can't visualize it. They don't know what to think about it. So I really hope that a lot of Catholics, and not LGBT Catholics, but Catholics, read this book and they start thinking about that couple that he described there in those last few pages. Sounds just like a really nice straight Catholic couple that I know, you know, or maybe my children, or, you know, whatever it is. But it's like, I hope that they think about the life that Michael and I have shared together in the church, and they start to think there's really nothing wrong with same-sex marriage, and it's something that should be championed by our church. It should be blessed by our church. And, you know, I don't know, John, if we're going to see that in my lifetime. I kind of doubt it. But a lot of things have happened in my lifetime that I wouldn't have predicted. So I suppose that's still possible. But really, that's what I wanted to do, especially at the end of the book, was just to kind of lay out this picture for Catholics. It's like, give this a thought. This is what it could look like if you had same-sex married people in the church. And I think it's a pretty nice picture.
Yeah, you do paint a beautiful picture in that last chapter.
Thank you.
Well, Greg, thanks so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you and hearing more about your book.
Well, thank you, John. It's been a pleasure talking to you, too. I certainly hope folks will give my book a try.
And to our listeners, if you're interested in reading Gay Catholic and American, click on the highlighted title of the book in the description that's included with this podcast. And you can also go directly to the University of Notre Dame Press website. And join us again next time for Queer Voices of the South on the New Books Network.